And with us tonight on the phone, but on one of those ISDN lines, so it sounds as if he's in the studio, is a distinguished young British historian, Simon Sebag Montefiore, who is the author of a new book, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. I've been reading it with utter fascination and also with fascinated horror over the last few days. That book is just published by Knopf. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
How nice to have you with us. I think the proper way to begin is with a biblical quotation, 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 6. Saul has killed his thousands. David has killed his tens of thousands. Shall we think of Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin as David? And if so, who were his various Sauls?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I think Stalin certainly would have known that story well. He'd studied his Bible, and throughout
he'd been a seminarian. In fact,
he was a seminarian. He was a trained priest. He'd been to church school. He was a choir boy, and he knew his Bible and quoted from it throughout his life. So he certainly would have understood that that reference.
It came to my mind while reading your book, because what becomes very clear in your book is that though Stalin is the great criminal who is ultimately responsible for some 60 million people having been exterminated as a matter of state, he certainly didn't do it alone. He had about him a circle, and these are the magnates, as you call them, the other ranking members of the Communist Party, of the Communist hierarchy, Politburo and Central Committee members, who did an awful lot of killing as ordered by Stalin, or often persuaded Stalin, let's go kill 100 people here and let's go wipe out these 20 Bolshevik comrades there. And that went on for years and years and years.
That's right. I think what we need to understand, I think the central theme of this book, is that the idea was rotten from the beginning and the system was rotten from the beginning. There was no wonderful Lenin and then Stalin personally came along and destroyed it all and ruined it all. No, I mean, Bolshevism, this was from the very start a creed, a sort of religious movement almost, based on the random killing of classes in order to create a workers' paradise later. And all of them believed in that.
And don't you indeed find evidence of that sort of random killing, or that systematic killing of potential enemies or people who have some doubts? Don't you find that long before Stalin attains the highest power? Don't we find it even in the history of Lenin and of Trotsky?
Absolutely. I mean, Molotov, who knew what he was talking about, said that if you thought Stalin was harsh, you should see Trotsky and Lenin. And Lenin himself was always saying things like, let the peasants starve. And it was he, too, who said that a revolution without firing squads was meaningless. And they really believed in terror, these people.
There's a telegram from Lenin, whether it's to Trotsky or somebody else, way back in 1919 or 1920, where he says, and to really make this clear, find 200 farmers and kill them.
That's right. And another time he says, and find 200 priests and hang them in public.
Yeah.
So it really was rotten from the beginning, and I think that's the key thing. And you're absolutely right. I mean, this really is a story of an ideal gone wrong, and it really is a chronicle of depravity, debauchery, degeneracy, perversion, sadism, and of course, love, and luxury, too.
And yet, I'm a psychologist by training, but I think psychobabble, as you do, you say this someplace, is always a mistake when it comes to historical interpretation.
That's right.
And but yet, when you look at these people, warts and all, and they've surely got warts, there, but for the grace of a democratic society, go I, or at least some other commanders of this society. You get the sense that the system made all of this happen, rather than particular deep evil in these men.
That's right. And in fact, I mean, Beria, Lavrenti Beria, the secret police chief, sinister pervert, mass murderer, sadist, but also one of the most gifted of Stalin's men.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter-in-law, who I interviewed for the book, said that it was a tragedy that Beria had been born at the time in the place that he was, because he became the monster that he became. But she said if he'd moved to America, he might have become chairman of General Motors.
Mm-hmm. Is that a reasonable conjecture, do you think?
Oh, definitely. I mean, he was incredibly gifted statesman and manager, but as well as being this absolute grotesque sadist.
That leads you inevitably to the counterfactual proposition, always worth examining by way of counterfactual invention, whether things might have turned out differently if some crucial people had not been there. Suppose that Stalin had died early, and perhaps even pre-deceased Lenin, so that the likely inheritor who would have achieved power would have been Trotsky. Would the history of the Soviet Union have turned out much differently?
Yeah, I still think it would have been. I still think it would have been very bloody, and there still would have been. I think there still would have been collectivization, because that, after all, was a leftist Trotskyite policy in the first place that Stalin borrowed. So that would have happened. I'm not sure the Great Terror would have happened in quite the same way, but certainly the revolution would have been bloody and would have consumed its own children.
The great madness, to begin with, is that very program that you've just named, collectivization. That meant taking all the small landholding peasants and pushing them into collective farms, and trying to get rid of the somewhat more prosperous landowners. I guess that's measured by whether you've got a cow.
That's right.
and killing loads of them. And one of the easy ways to do that, since they needed credits in the outer world anyway to buy industrial machinery and to proceed along the rapid industrialization they were hoping to accomplish, one of the ways to do that is to take all the grain you can find and ship it out of the country and get economic credits for it. Therefore, an easy thing to do would be to starve the population of the Ukraine, starve them to death, get rid of a lot of troublesome kind of resistant peasants, and helps build the collectivization program, and poof, two problems are solved in one fell swoop.
That's right, because they hated the peasantry. I mean, one of the fascinating things I found in this amazing treasure trove of archives that this book is based on, Stalin's own private papers, is a decree where they said, we're going to divide these peasants into three parts.
Yeah.
One part will be deported, one part will be imprisoned, and the third part will be shot. And this ultimately came to include millions and millions of people in in those three categories.
The first great horrific event in the history of the cruelty of in the Soviet Union, the democide or genocide within the Soviet Union, is of course the Ukrainian famine.
That's right.
In the years 32 and 33.
That's right.
I know that you've been much influenced by, and indeed you've also, in your acknowledgments, you note that he has assisted or responded to you and been of some value, some help to you, the great historical scholar who's focused on all of this, namely Robert Conquest, who was on our program talking about these matters a good 10 or 12 years ago. Let's look at the Ukrainian devastation.
Yes, I mean Robert Conquest is of course the great the giant of this subject, but I mean the famine was a deliberate famine used by Stalin and his men to basically what they called break the back of the peasantry. And indeed, in many of these letters which I've studied and which I found in this archive, that's the phrase they use, these brutal men. They constantly talked about, let's break the back of the peasantry, by which they meant, let's starve them to death.
Did the peasantry really stand in opposition to them, or was this just an idée fixe with which they deluded themselves?
No, I think that the peasants were in their way. The peasants had always been opposed to the revolution. I mean, the strange thing about the revolution is you've got to realize a tiny group of people, maybe even as few as 5,000 people, was the Bolshevik Party. The equivalent here would be Lyndon LaRouche taking power in America. And it's a really quite close parallel. I mean, you know, also a mixture of religious and political beliefs of a tiny group of people, you know, connected across the country.
I love the LaRouche comparison, but does it fully apply? Were the other journalists, intellectuals, members of the Duma and so on, were they all convinced that Lenin and his small band were as crazy as almost all of us think the LaRouches are?
Yeah, I mean, most of them just thought they were they were such a minority party that they, no one ever thought they'd come to power. It was only due to the political genius of Lenin that they managed to. And he understood how to organize a party to create professional revolutionaries, a tightly knit group of people absolutely devoted to the party, placing the party above family, above friendship, and united by a military discipline and an absolute belief in Marxism-Leninism. And they talked about themselves continually, and this is very important in the book, they talked about themselves as knights in shining armor, knights with their swords cutting off what is rotten. They saw themselves as almost a sort of order of priest warriors, like the Knights Templar, or like the Taliban, if you like.
Yeah. As you open your volume, you zero in on a tragic scene, a tragic event, namely the suicide of Stalin's wife, Aleluyeva. She apparently was somewhat bothered by the starvations of the millions in the Ukraine, but these fellows are wining and dining and doing their drunken dances, and in general having a lot of sociability with one another and with one another's families during all of this horrible time, fully aware of the fact that they are responsible for the death of millions, which instantly poses the question, how could they have done it?
They believed. They were believers. I mean, this is really a story, as I said, about about religious fanatics backed by violence, believing in violence. And it's something we're very familiar with today in our world. And they absolutely believed in it. They had no problem with it. They prided themselves on their hardness and their flint hearts.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, one instantly draws comparisons to other major totalitarian movements, murderous movements, certainly to the Nazis. Hitler always spoke of himself and of his best Nazis as having what he called Eiserne Wille, iron will. Nothing daunts us, nothing will stop us from the pursuit of our purpose.
Yes, that's very similar to Stalin. He talked about bull nerves.
Mm-hmm.
The nerves of a bull is what he wanted his men to have, which is a very interesting parallel. But you see, the difference between the two of them was that Hitler created his party and created it round him as Führer. Stalin had to win his way to the leadership, charm his way to the leadership. And the Bolsheviks were an oligarchy. And there was almost a sort of, in the Politburo, in the Central Committee, there was a democracy within that oligarchy. He had to overcome that from the inside. And that's why his rise to power is so different, and why Hitler never needed to wipe out his own circle, but Stalin did.
Quite so. In fact, it was probably Lenin who coined the phrase democratic centralism, wasn't it?
That's right.
That being what would prevail within the Central Committee and the Politburo. Among the leadership, there would be the absolute equality of leaders who would work out a consensual policy.
That's right. And then once the party rule was set, it had to be obeyed throughout the party. But there could be discussion until it was decided.
And so it was during the 1920s, as Stalin consolidates his power after Lenin's death. But of course, it changed, as you say. You've already indicated that one of the main themes of your book, and it is a fascinating revelation in your book, fully documented, is that Stalin was a great charmer, could be in many ways extremely kind and thoughtful and courteous to all sorts of people, and he charmed his way to the ultimate power, which once attained allowed him to kill half of the people he had charmed.
That's right. I mean, one of the first documents I found in this amazing treasure trove that I keep mentioning was a list of cars.
Yeah.
I looked at it. It was in Stalin's handwriting. And basically it said, I saw all these words, Buick, Packard cars, American cars.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to look at it, and then I realized that Stalin actually personally decided which person got which car. So, for example, this list said, Molotov family will receive 2 Packards, a Buick and a Rolls-Royce. And Beria family will receive 3 Buicks and so on. And they all had these American cars, which they loved. So that just gave you an idea, that gave me a hint for the first time of the detail he would take care of his people.
We must, after some commercials which are coming almost instantly, we must plunge into the material about the personal lives, not only of Stalin, but of some of the other major figures around him, Kaganovich, Beria, Molotov, Zhdanov, and of course his good friend who was not ultimately saved by that good friendship. I've never known how to pronounce the name of Orjonikidze, is that right?
Yeah, Orjonikidze, yeah.
Orjonikidze, One never knows for sure where you put the stress in those.
That's right.
And that's
Georgian
a Georgian,
names.
That's a Georgian name rather than a Russian name. We will return and look at these guys in closer detail and examine their life together as we continue with Simon Sebag Montefiore after these words. And we return to Simon Sebag Montefiore, who is the author of a book published a little while ago, I think probably about 3 or 4 months ago, in the UK, and just recently published in this country by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. That volume, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. And let's talk a little bit about the making of this book before we return to the principals whom you are introducing us to in this book, or whose lives you are introducing to us. You're still a pretty young guy, 39 by my reckoning.
Yeah, 38, yes.
But you spent about 9 or 10 years knocking around in the former Soviet Union.
Yeah, I was a war correspondent in the wars in the Caucasus, and I was in Grozny, I was in the civil wars in Georgia. It was a great adventure for a young person to be. It's a great privilege to see these great events of history being actually made before your eyes.
You got shot at a few times, I gather.
I did. I got shot at quite a lot, and I had some terrifying experiences that convinced me that my time might be better spent writing history books instead.
And you had you were doing a lot of reportage for the New York Times, the London Times, the Spectator, was it?
Yes, I was with Shevardnadze a lot. I got to know all the presidents and leaders in the Caucasus, and traveled with them a lot. I was with the first president of Georgia, which is, many of your listeners will know, is a small mountain-bound republic.
Sure.
With its own special language on the Black Sea. It used to be part of the Soviet Union, and it was where Stalin was born. And Stalin was a Georgian, very much a Georgian, too.
And Shevardnadze, of course, was earlier the foreign minister of the Soviet Union.
Exactly, and that was a fascinating... You know, it was a great adventure for a young person to be driving around the Caucasus in convoys of gangster-filled red Mercedes with gunmen hanging off the running boards and, you know, constant danger of assassination. I always remember in these situations, these ruffians would always... they'd always put on Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. They'd always put on that album for some reason as music, which seemed very suitable in these completely surreal moments.
But you got away from that surreal world by spending a lot of time in the archives up in Moscow, did you not?
That's right. I started to write a book about Prince Potemkin, Catherine the Great's prime minister and a lover, and I was very fortunate to get the sort of first person to write a full biography of him, which is also coming out next year from Knopf. But Stalin was the most exciting thing. I mean, I was just very fortunate to come across these archives at the time I did, and I've been lucky that I'm really the first person that can break them open, as it were.
You seem to have almost every note that he scribbled.
Well, I mean, you know, when this archive opened, I just simply couldn't believe. And there it was. There were love letters from Stalin to his girlfriends in Siberia. There were his love letters to and from his wife Nadia. There were the sweet letters between him and his daughter Svetlana. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she used to pretend to be the ruler of Russia, and she used to call Stalin and Molotov and everyone her little secretaries. And you can see these little notes. She'd say, to my little secretaries, comrade Stalin and Molotov, I order homework to be banned this year. Mm. And Stalin would write, I obey you, I obey you, my little boss. And Molotov would sign, obeyed Molotov. And so, you know, there were scenes of these kind of quite sweet scenes of that sort of thing. And then, there were amazing photo albums. There were letters, there were Molotov's love letters. But above all, there was just Stalin's amazing correspondence, some of it showing his wit, some of it showing him writing song verses for movies, some of it where he would apologize to people he'd lost his temper with, showing that he wasn't quite yet full dictator. And there were also lots of letters from sort of groupies to Stalin. I mean, one of the classic letter was one that's from a young school teacher in her 20s who said, "Dear Comrade Stalin, I must meet you for a secret audience. I'm a 23-year-old school teacher from Saratov or somewhere, I'd see you in my dreams and fantasies all the time. Can we meet?" And then it was P.S., photograph enclosed. And Stalin wrote back in his own handwriting, "Dear Comrade Unfamiliar, I'm afraid I haven't got time to see you, but I still respect you despite your request. Signed, J. Stalin." And then in a very sort of dry touch, very typical of Stalin's humor, he said, "P.S., photograph returned."
The general image we've had of Stalin and it's come through many of the studies that we've had, is of a dour, tight fellow, menacing, strangely fitful and implacable, and by no means charming, mumbling when he gives a speech, and just intimidating by virtue of the death that he held in his hands. You give a very different picture. To begin with, you say he has grace and social charm. You also say he was really quite an intellectual. Your word.
Yeah. I think he was always kind of rough, but he could be very seductive when he wanted to be, very feline. And if he turned his full attention to you, he was pretty irresistible. I mean, I think that, you know, he had to win his way, and he did that by many different ways. I mean, I think I mentioned about the cars that he would assign to each, the Buicks and Packards that he would assign to each family. Another classic occasion was, for example, when Beria moved to Moscow. Stalin would, you know, sent one of his top people to actually arrange the removal from Tbilisi, from the regions, to Moscow. Then he chose the house. He arrived at the house and asked if Mrs. Beria liked it. When Mrs. Beria didn't like it, Stalin found them another house that they did like. He then tucked in Beria's son and read him stories in bed. I mean, here was someone who could really look after people and make them feel that they were very special.
This wasn't all then simply a matter of duplicity. For him to have done it that well, it must have flowed with some authenticity from some side of his nature.
Yeah, I think he wanted to be a warmer person than he was, probably. I mean, I think all this was going on at the same time. One has to say he was an extremely harsh fanatic. He believed in Marxism-Leninism with what Beria said, interestingly, very interesting words, with quasi-Islamic fanaticism. Yeah. And that's interesting. But you mentioned the intellectual thing. That's a fascinating side of him. And that's one of the things I found in these archives. I
yes,
went to his library.
It quite surprised me, as a matter of fact.
I mean, you know, here was someone who, from the earliest age, devoured books. When he arrived at a Siberian village in exile, in the Tsar's exile, first thing he'd do was steal all his comrades' books, and then he'd steal their girlfriends. And, you know, he was more of an attractive figure than one sometimes gives him credit for as well. I mean, you know, Dr. Kissinger has always famously said that power is the greatest aphrodisiac, and no one doubts that. But this was when he was an unknown, obscure, penniless Georgian peasant in exile, and yet he was never without a girlfriend and left a trail of illegitimate children behind him.
Yes, you say in the book, how many have you been able to authenticate?
Well, there are at least three or four, and you know, none of them received any favour except one of them. One of them was going to be arrested in the Terror, and then wrote to Stalin and just was let off. And often on these lists, Stalin would go down the death list, and if he just put a dash next to a name, that meant hold off on the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And that would, but you know, but the reading, the intellectual stuff is really interesting. I mean, he really did appreciate literary genius, even though it was always subordinate to political, his political requirements.
You've got a scene there where he calls together a bunch of the, quote, leading writers of Russia, or of the Soviet Union, sits them down and tells them, in essence, announces the program of socialist realism.
That's
right. Tells them they're going to have to do a different kind of writing from now on.
That's right. And that, of course, was an incredibly brutish and tedious idea, too. I mean, it ruined the writing, it ruined the literature of the Soviet Union for 30 years, really. And yet, here was a man, famously, I think a story that sums it up best. I mean, first of all, you know, he loved reading books like Last of the Mohicans. And in fact, I was amazed to find out that he quite often used to meet favoured younger, you know, civil servants and stuff with sort of that, you know, mock Native American talk, like, hello, pale face, Big Chief says hello, if he'd been reading it lately. And he also loved Galsworthy, the Forsyte saga. But he'd read all of his Victor Hugo, all of his Balzac, all of his Zola. He'd read Goethe. I mean, he loved history. And whenever he was studying it, whenever he was in a certain position, he'd read up the history. For example, when he was dealing with Hitler, he read about Bismarck. When he was dealing with Churchill, he read about Churchill's ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, so he could talk about that with Churchill. So he was always studying, and he was an autodidact.
Now, let's look at some of the men around him. They figure quite prominently in your book, of course. They are... Why do you call them magnates?
They were, you know, normally, you know, in most history books, these people were presented as men without biographies, sort of dreary men mm-hmm. with moustaches standing behind Stalin. You know, they weren't. They were, many of them, I mean, some of them were just brutes, some of them were just perverts, some of them were just thugs, but they were all in their way capable. And they were quite extraordinary. Now, they were people who joined the revolutionary movement as young men, as teenagers often.
Well, when your book begins, Stalin is approaching 50, and most of the other leading Bolsheviks around him are in their 30s.
That's right. They're very young. They're very dynamic. I mean, you know, the comment about Beria becoming head of General Motors is kind of interesting. I mean, he was the most sophisticated of them all, Beria. He was capable of running vast empires of the economy, the arms industry, and so on. And some of them were much more simple. I mean, Kaganovich was just, you know, he was an ex-cobbler. And whenever anyone came into his office, he used to say, "Get your boots off. Let's have a look at them."
Yeah.
And he'd look at their boots and check that the leather was good, you know. Other times he used to lose his temper and lift people up by their lapels and throw them across the room. So, you know, these were pretty rough people, a lot of them.
Have you ever encountered a book? I forget the name of the author, but it's titled Kaganovich, The Wolf of the Kremlin.
Yes.
That fellow, the American, I think, grandnephew of Kaganovich.
Yeah, he was some relative, but it's got a lot of mistakes in it.
I wouldn't be surprised, but he did go back there, and he bearded old Kaganovich, who was then about 93 or 95,
yeah,
and literally got a chance to talk with his granduncle about
That's
these
right.
times. I had him on this program whenever that book was published, probably a good 15 years ago, I think.
Yes. Kaganovich was an interesting character because he was Jewish, of course.
Yeah.
He was the top Jew, one of the two top Jews close to Stalin.
Who was the other?
Meklis, who was a terrifying character known as the Gloomy Demon, was his nickname.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a sort of maniac. He was an absolute maniac. Capable of just having umpteen people shot all the time. And even Stalin thought he was a big joke. And even Stalin laughed. He'd say, "Oh, Meklis is a complete maniac," he used to say, after encouraging him, of course.
He seemed to have strong crushes, and I'm not implying homosexuality, but strong feelings towards various of his colleagues as well, though they were evanescent. One of the interesting relationships in this book is that between Stalin and Kirov.
That's right. He was very attractive. Stalin was in many ways a sort of gloomy person. He was never happy. He was very attracted to these kind of bluff, hail fellow, well met people who, you know, Kirov was a handsome young guy, always singing opera aloud, who was easygoing and at ease in his own skin. And Stalin loved being around those sort of people.
And for a while, Kirov was assumed to be sort of the successor in waiting.
That's right. Some people assume that. And but Kirov, you know, Kirov is sort of like, Kirov's assassination has made him probably more of an important person than he really
uh-huh.
was. But, you know, he never had the sort of credentials to succeed to the throne.
His assassination in Leningrad in, what is it, the year, 33?
34.
34.
December 34.
Yeah. In the Smolny Institute, where much of the original Bolshevik Revolution occurred, as a matter of fact.
Exactly.
That was the beginning of the, going beyond the millions killed in the Ukraine, that was the beginning of the depredations against other communists, the beginning of the terror within the broad realm of the Communist Party.
Yeah.
There remains some ambiguity as to whether Stalin indeed had ordered or had some hand in the assassination of Kirov. What's your own judgment on that?
You know, my sort of instinct is that I actually sense in my waters, as it were, in my gut, that he didn't arrange it. And in the book, you'll note that I carefully sit on the fence, simply because we don't know enough one way or the other. And I just don't think he did. When all is mm-hmm. considered, I just don't think so.
Am I right in the judgment that sparked off the beginning of the terror?
Yeah, that was a sort of excuse. After that, they passed the 1st of December law, which meant that they could shoot anybody as soon as they liked, which was just, you know, a sort of carte blanche to kill anyone. But what's interesting about it is that, you know, it started off as a terror against the top opposition people, you know, Zinoviev, Trotsky, Trotsky's people, and everyone in the Politburo was very happy about that and thought it was quite a good idea. They weren't afraid yet. I don't think it occurred to any of them that they would be next. And
yeah.
And you know, one of the fascinating things that I mentioned in the book is that, you know, some of these people, a couple of them, were invited to dinner with Stalin. You know, in 1935, when, you know, the history books have told us the terror has already started and everyone should have been on their toes, this couple were invited to dinner at Stalin's and forgot to turn up because they knew him so well. They'd known him for 30 years. And they just sort of, you know, presumed that they get invited so often that he wouldn't mind. And that was a sort of big mistake to make with Stalin, because he regarded himself as super special,
yeah,
messianic. no longer a private individual, but Stalin, the symbol of the revolution, not an individual.
You know, speaking of dinner with Stalin, some years ago, Lord Bullock was here, Alan Bullock.
Oh, yes.
And of course, he did that great final work of his, Hitler and Stalin.
Yeah, great work.
And reading up for that, I ran across this wonderful anecdote, and I brought it up with Bullock. Some journalist in England did ask him, if you had a choice, you had to spend a weekend either with Hitler or with Stalin, which one would you choose? And Bullock's famous answer was, oh, Hitler, of course. I would have been dreadfully bored, a very unpleasant man, and quite a fanatic. But I would have left, come down from the Berghof at the end
yes.
of the weekend, whereas if I'd gone to spend a weekend with Stalin, I might not have come out alive.
So one of the fascinating people I met in my research was a young man who actually was about 25 and was interpreting for some British MPs, members of Parliament, who were visiting mm-hmm. Stalin after the war. And at the end of this, Stalin suddenly pointed to him and said, why don't you stay with me for a week? And this was down on the Black Sea, one of the dachas down there,
yeah.
one of the sort of mansions down there. And so this young man had to stay with Stalin on his own, just him and Stalin, for a whole week. And he told me all about it. It was just remarkable. Stalin, you know, would have dinner and lunch with him every day. And this young man was like, every guest who stayed with Stalin was longing to leave. He was terrified. He didn't dare initiate anything.
Yes.
And in the end, he said, Comrade Stalin, I'm afraid I really do have to go back to Moscow. And he said, why? And he said, because I've got to, you know, join the Communist Party. And Stalin said, ooh, that's a very important thing. And Stalin said, you know, I won't be lonely. I learnt to be on my own in prison, as he said goodbye. And he gave the young man a great big basket of fruit and oranges, and which he'd grown himself. He loved growing. He was a great gardener. And the young man went off feeling very relieved. But when the young man, what I forgot to say is when he told the young man he was going to stay with him, he said, let's get you drunk a bit and see what kind of person you are, he said.
Uh-huh.
Which, of course, was a terrifying comment. But this young man has just died now, and I was fortunate enough to interview him.
Who is that?
He was called Troyanovsky, Alec Troyanovsky.
Oh, I met him once.
Yeah, I bet you did. He came to America.
Yes.
He became Khrushchev's top advisor.
Yes, indeed.
And ambassador to Japan at one point.
But he had been a translator way back at Stalin's
yes.
side, yeah.
Yeah, this was him. And he was a fascinating character also, because his father, Troyanovsky's father, the reason why Stalin picked on him to stay was because Stalin knew the family very well.
Yeah.
And when Stalin was in Vienna in 1912-13, he'd stayed in Troyanovsky's father's house.
Uh-huh.
And he was, you know, once Troyanovsky, the father, was walking down the street in the 20s, and someone put their arm around him from behind and had their hand over his eyes and said, are you a friend or an enemy? And he looked around and he said, oh, it was Stalin. He said, oh, you're teasing me, Stalin.
This is so fascinating. I am 10 minutes late for commercials. So I must absent me from Felicity a while. We'll be directly back to Simon Sebag Montefiore after these words. And directly back to Simon Sebag Montefiore, who is the author of this exceptionally interesting new book, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, that's just published in this country by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. Let us come to the beginning of the purges and of the Great Terror within the party. If you take people like, the major victims of the first wave of purge trials, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Bukharin, Radek, etc., were they, in some sense, a real opposition, or had they been?
They had been, but they'd completely broken and sworn their allegiance to Stalin. But he needed them to die for various reasons. I think partly it was the Bolshevik way. Partly for himself, he wanted vengeance. He'd felt humiliated by them. And partly, I think, he felt that they would be a potential opposition if, for example, Hitler invaded and his leadership could be questioned.
I often think when it comes to things of this sort, when it comes to totalitarian murder, that when it comes to the prime despot, I think of Macbeth, who says as things begin to look rather shaky, though he's killed the King of Scotland and become the King of Scotland, he has said, to be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus. And he doesn't feel safe. Duncan is rather, who's coming on? He's already killed Banquo. What's the name? Malcolm is coming
Malcolm.
On, yes.
So funny you should say that, because actually I was just thinking safety as you said that. Great minds think alike. You know, I think that's exactly right. He wanted to be safe. He always wanted to be safe, and he could never, you know, that's what he wanted, absolute certainty. Stalin always wanted dependability, was what he
But
wanted.
is this where we do have to turn a bit towards the psychologizing temptation?
Sure.
If you go far enough with that sort of thing, and he went more than far enough,
Yes.
it does suggest that you've developed paranoid ideation.
You know, one of the things, interesting things about paranoia, and this is what I kind of go into in the book. Yes, Stalin was paranoid, but the whole Bolshevik party was paranoid. That's why all the other Bolsheviks were totally on board for this, because they had every reason to be paranoid. Lenin had been shot, Kirov had been shot. You know, they were surrounded by enemies. Poland was against them. Germany was rising again. They were already at war in Spain. The Japanese were skirmishing with them in the Far East. They were actually at war already. They had every reason to be paranoid. Stalin just took it that little bit further, but it was already there. The Bolsheviks regarded hardness as their and pitilessness as their first virtue, and vigilance as their second, which was their word for paranoia.
But he didn't just kill the 50 or so leftover, slightly disgraced former Bolsheviks who were now sort of out of power
No.
and who, for a while, were friendly to Trotsky, who had been the main challenge when Stalin was struggling to achieve primary power after Lenin's death. He didn't just kill those 50 or those 100. He managed to kill about a million members of the Communist Party, isn't that right?
Yeah, you know, the bizarre thing about it was that, you see, because the communists, the Bolsheviks, were already quite used to killing vast numbers of people at random by class, because that was the essence of the black bloodletting was the essence of Marxism-Leninism. They thought nothing of the fact when he said, "Listen, we've just got to wipe out the whole of this soft class of the Bolshevik elite. They're all fat cats who've got used to their second houses and their privileges. We're going to wipe them out." And obviously, the top leaders that round him said, "Yeah, that's probably a good idea. We'll just wipe them out." So what they did was, and this is one of the amazing things we've discovered, you know, Robert Conquest was right all along. The amazing thing we discovered is that they actually made a memo where they actually told people, but to kill by quota. So they'd say, you know, Minneapolis, you kill 20,000. New York, you kill 50,000. You know, Chicago, 25,000, please. And of course, these maniacs in the provinces, like Khrushchev or whoever was in charge, they killed more than their quota just to show how keen they were, which is, I mean, that really is madness. But it's not Stalin's madness, it's a group madness, isn't it?
It's interesting you mentioned Khrushchev. I was really rather stunned in reading this book. The first major purge trial in Moscow is over, and Khrushchev, there's a great big rally, and everyone's cheering for the death of these Trotskyite wreckers or whatever they are. And the main person to address them is Khrushchev, who
Yeah.
whips them into great, excited, happy frenzy over the fact that the great Stalin is still there and he will protect them from all of these evil plotters.
Yeah.
One doesn't think of Khrushchev as being in the middle of all of this that early.
No, he was also saying, he was saying, you know, Trotsky is Judas, so who's Stalin? You know, and this religious thing comes back. You know, Khrushchev actually was the protege of Stalin's wife, Nadia, and you know, he became Stalin's favorite. And one of the reasons why Stalin loved him was because he was so primitive and looked so ridiculous with his bald head and his big ears and his funny teeth, the golden teeth were what several missing, that Stalin thought he was absolutely, you know, he was an absolute hobbledehoy, and would be no competition. But he was an absolute maniac and fanatic when it came to killing these people. He wiped out lots.
And of course, he for a while was in charge of the killings in the Ukraine, wasn't he?
Yeah, he exceeded his quota in Moscow and in Ukraine. Just to give you an idea of how fanatical he was, and you know, exceeding the quota was just—it was a sort of madness. You know, I mean, to think that he would just—these people were people they didn't even know—but then they killed another 40,000. Stalin killed another 40,000 that he did know intimately, and these 40,000, he was sent. It was sent. The names were sent to him in albums. They were called in. They were in Russian. They were called albums, because they had each one had a little photo of the person in case Stalin had forgotten who it was, and he'd go down the list and either tick them or sign it. And oftentimes they'd write things beside the names. They'd pass it round the table at the Politburo, and they'd write things like "kill that whore," "shoot that traitor," and that sort of thing, or "beat him hard," or that sort of thing. So you're really dealing with this kind of, you know, the gangsterism, the cruelty, the sadism, was only just under the surface of this super privileged world. I mean, Yezhov, the poison dwarf of the terror, one of Stalin's top killers, he'd turn up to cabinet meetings with dirty shirt cuffs, speckled with a brown substance. And Khrushchev once said, "Yezhov, what's that you've got on your shirt cuffs? Your shirt's dirty." And Yezhov, who'd been drinking and torturing people all night, said, This, I'm proud to say, is the blood of an enemy of the people that I've been torturing.
Yes, I discover from your book that not only Yezhov, but others, including Beria, engaged in actual physical torture. They didn't just order people to torture others. They rather enjoyed putting the knife in themselves.
Well, I mean, Beria was particularly creative in all this. And when he came to Moscow, him and Stalin enjoyed sharing that sort of slight Georgian taste for sort of romantic brigandage, in which they used to arrange things like kidnapping people's wives. I mean, one famous case where Marshal Kulik, he had a beautiful and very sexy wife, the sexiest girl in the court of Stalin, really. But she'd made a mistake of sort of teasing Stalin and asking him to release her brother, and from jail, because she was an aristocrat. She was actually a countess, believe it or not. And so Stalin did a typical thing. He ordered Beria to kidnap the beautiful wife, and then he promoted the general to marshal that day. And then, of course, poor Marshal Kulik wondered where his wife had got to. So he went to see Beria, and Beria said, I don't know where she's got to, but I'm going to phone Stalin. So then he phoned Stalin and said, Stalin, what are we going to do? We've got Marshal Kulik, newly promoted in my office, asking where his wife is. Have you heard anything? And Stalin said, I haven't heard anything. Have you heard anything? And Beria said, nothing. And, you know, she was actually in a cell about 200 yards underneath that office. And then she was shot in the back of the head, and she was 28 years old.
Oh, my God. Do we have any evidence at any point of any qualms of conscience ever being directly or indirectly expressed by any of these men?
Yeah, in a weird sort of way, there's one famous case where Stalin was at a dinner at Stalin's place after the war, and Stalin there was another one of these generals there, and the general said, Stalin said, "You look exhausted. How are you?" And he said, "Not too good. I've been in jail for a year, and I, you know, a lot of people." He said, "Poor you." He said, "There are too many yes men in this country," said Stalin. "How awful! What do they do to you?" They said, "They tortured me and everything, and there were many innocent people were killed there." Suddenly, Stalin got up from the table and walked out of the French windows into the garden. And all the other comrades, all the other magnates around the table said, "How could you mention the terror to him? You ruined his evening. How could you? How dare you?" And suddenly, Stalin came back in again. And he was carrying a bouquet of his beloved roses. Roses and mimosas were his favorite flowers, incidentally. And he walked in with them, and he presented this bouquet of roses to the general. And he just sat down again and continued with his dinner and said nothing.
These are indeed strange people. But the question is whether one can account for it all, but in terms of some historical process that makes some sense. I have something contributed by one of the best political scientists I know about, namely Rudolf Rummel, who has studied what he calls democide, meaning genocide and politicide, as he labels it, in the 20th century. And he's got a theory of democide, which I want to put before you, yeah, right after we pause for these words. And to quickly reintroduce our guest, he is Simon Sebag Montefiore, who is the author of the new book, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, just published by Alfred Knopf and Company. Simon is in Boston at the moment, talking to us on an ISDN line. Thus, it sounds as if he's in the studio. And I'm sorry you're not in the studio, but I'm delighted that you're here.
Me too.
I said I wanted to read something to you. Rudolf Rummel is a political scientist who's done major work on what he calls democide, which means essentially people killed as a policy of state, but not in war, not in uniform or civilians destroyed during a military assault. Rather, people killed as a matter of policy by those who hold political power. He calls that democide, and includes genocide and politicide, by which he means the killing of classes of people defined politically or defined in terms of social class or what have you. He's done extensive demographic research on all of this and has come up with estimates of how many people were killed by which regimes. And the USSR leads all the rest. In the 20th century, up to 1987, when he put all of this work together, the USSR had killed, in the USSR, there had been 61, almost 62 million killed. Next in line is China during the reign of the People's Republic of China, 49 up till his year 87, 35 million. Germany, during the Nazi years, killed 20 million people. We know that some 6 million of those were Jews. We know who some of the other categories were. We know that they killed by willful starving some 2 million Soviet military prisoners, and that would count as democide because they were no longer actively operating as military. He then goes on, Rommel does, and pardon me for taking so long with this, but I want to put this before you. He goes on to lay out what he calls a theory of democide, and now I read. The theoretical hypothesis is that the more democratic freedom a nation has, the less likely its government will commit foreign or domestic democide. In brief summary, social conflicts that might become violent are resolved by voting, negotiation, compromise, and mediation. He goes on to develop that about how democratic societies work. And then he says, on the other side are totalitarian political regimes. Rather than being a means for resolving differences in views, they try to impose a particular ideology, religion, or solution to social problems on society, regardless of the opposition. For this reason, such regimes try to control all aspects of society and deal with conflict by force, coercion, and fear, that is, by power. Moreover, such power breeds political paranoia by the dictator or within a narrow ruling group. This is the fear that others are always plotting to take over rule and would execute those now in power. Finally, there is one hierarchical pyramid of power rather than a multitude of such pyramids as in a democracy. One single coercive organization, this turns all socio-political and economic issues and problems into a matter of us versus them, of those with power versus those without. We should therefore find that the less democratic a regime, the more unchecked and unbalanced power at the center, the more it should commit democide. Democide becomes a device of rule, as in eliminating possible opponents, or a means for achieving one's ideological goal, as in the purification of one's country, of an alien race, or the reconstruction of society. Doesn't that apply?
Absolutely. That's wonderfully clear-sighted, I think, and clearly put. I mean, you know, the strange thing is that the Bolsheviks never concealed their brutality. They advertised it. It's just that no one quite believed that they were actually, you know, going to carry it through. I mean, as I mentioned all this stuff about knights in shining armor, and you know, and the fact that Stalin was constantly advertised as this tough man, this hard man, boy, did they mean it, didn't they?
In this context, what do we make of that other great assault upon the lives of people, quite apart from the Ukrainian starvations, quite apart from the purge trials and the reign of terror within the Communist Party? What about the Gulag? And how many millions were killed in the Gulag, does one know?
I mean, we know that 20 million people went through it at one time or another, and that 28 million people went into were deported. So you know, you're talking vast numbers here. I mean, the great use of the Gulag was meant to be economic, of course. I mean, there's some evidence they actually sent people there in order to provide this workforce.
It was slave labor, to be sure.
It was slave labor. But the ironic thing is that Beria, who was, as I said, much the most sophisticated of these cutthroats, realized that it was actually a very inefficient way of running an economy. And in fact,
well, your workers kept dying on you.
Your workers kept dying on you, and anyway, their work was very inefficient, and it actually cost money rather than saving money, which was ironic. And of course, Beria was always the most sort of, well, the least Bolshevik of them, I'd say. He was the one who probably was the only one that wasn't a real believer. And in fact, he told his, when I interviewed him, he told his daughter-in-law, he said, you know, I want my granddaughter to go to Oxford.
Yes.
He said. You know, and he really said that. And he said to another person, he said, you know, the Soviet Union will only work when there's private property. Well, this was shock. It would have been shocked Stalin to his core.
And right after Stalin's death, as I remember it, and you do of course, refer to this in the book, he seemed to be in the position to take primary power, and he began talking in those terms to the other members of the Politburo, and that's when they, led by Khrushchev, ganged up and killed him.
Yeah. The irony is that he was a sort of Gorbachev, early Gorbachev. Mm. But you know, I mean, Beria's behavior during Stalin's death was typical. You know, when Stalin was lying there after his stroke, breathing quietly, Beria was hissing at him, "You disgusting old man." The moment Stalin opened his eyes, Beria would throw himself to his feet, kiss Stalin's hand, and say, "Oh, come back, Joseph Vissarionovich, come back, please, get better, we need you." So, you know, he was a character who behaved like a sort of film noir villain in real life. And but of course, he was the person who was responsible for getting the Soviet Union the atom bomb. He was the most able person, and Stalin gave him that task.
Let us come to the later years, to the war, in fact. You certainly reinforce the interpretation we've had from yet other sources that Stalin had intelligence about the gathering storm and the scheduled Soviet, rather German invasion of the Soviet Union, but he chose not to believe it.
That's right. I mean, he said his big mistake, and this is very interesting, this is new material that I found. He said after the war, and the only conversation he had about whether he'd made a mistake or not, he said, you know, the mistake was that I put myself into his position and believed he'd behave as I would have behaved if I'd been in his position, which of course was madness, because Stalin was actually rather a cautious statesman in international affairs and behaved like a great power, real politician, as it were. Whilst Hitler, as we know, described himself as a sleepwalker, and was you know, a gambler who had to risk everything, you know, immediately. And another thing Stalin said that was very interesting just before the war was, he said, doesn't Hitler realise that, you know, Russia is not a country like England or France or Poland that can just be conquered? We're so much bigger than them. We're unique. And of course, the interesting thing is that Hitler didn't understand that. And didn't realize that the Soviet Union could withstand millions of losses and lose half its European territory and still outproduce and outfight Nazi Germany itself.
Perhaps Hitler had never heard of the Napoleonic invasion of Russia.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? But, you know, the war was a fascinating time for Stalin. I mean, at the beginning of it, he was shocked. He was humiliated that he'd got it so wrong. But, you know, the first few days he believed he was in control and they'd expel the German invaders. But on the 28th of June, just a week after the Operation Barbarossa had started, suddenly it struck him. And there's this amazing point when they say, Comrade Stalin, we've lost Minsk. And Minsk was on the, you know, Minsk was on the road to Smolensk, was on the road to Moscow, and suddenly the whole thing was collapsing. Mm-hmm. And then he just lost all confidence. He went into the headquarters, and he said to Zhukov, who was his most talented general, and then chief of staff, he said, where the hell are the armies? And Zhukov, the toughest man in the Soviet army, and that's saying something, burst into tears. And there's this surreal scene when Zhukov runs out of the room, and Molotov, who's as cold as ice, follows him out and offers him a handkerchief. And then they go back in, and then Stalin just realizes that they've lost the armies, the whole thing's collapsing. And then he has his famous collapse, when he says, you know, we've screwed it up. Everything Lenin left us, we've lost. And he just shuts himself in Kuntsevo, his country house just outside Moscow. And for 3 days, no one is running the war at all. And everyone wonders, what's happened to Stalin? Has he had a complete nervous breakdown? It's an amazing moment. And then they decide to go out and beg him to come back. And when they arrive, he thinks they've come to arrest him. He says, what have you come for? And they said, we've come to ask you to come back and take command. And he says, oh, I see. Well, that's all right then. And he came. He came back and he fulfilled what he regarded as his real destiny, to be a supreme warlord.
Was he, in fact, after that bad patch, did he pull himself together and run a war effectively, or was it won for him by others?
No, I mean, for about a year after that, he was a complete bungler. And in any other country, he'd have been arrested and shot mm-hmm. for ineptitude. He sent around his people like the dreaded gloomy demon Necklace and Kaganovich and these kind of complete military amateurs who lost millions of troops in disastrous offensives. Khrushchev also was part of one offensive, the Kharkov offensive, which lost, you know, almost a million troops. And afterwards, Stalin humiliated him, but by emptying his ash from his pipe on Khrushchev's bald pate. Mm. And he said, you know, I've been reading ancient history. And in ancient Rome, if a general lost an army, they put ashes on his head. So that's why I'm putting ashes on your head, he said. And Khrushchev took it. But then, just before Stalingrad, Stalin got the message finally. And he had this brilliant general, Marshal Zhukov. And he let his generals, Zhukov and Vasilevsky, run the war. And Stalin became suddenly a very competent supreme commander-in-chief. And that was how they won the war.
You know, turning away from the Soviet Union for just a moment, Hitler, of course, was profoundly irresponsible. He was more of a nut, I would say, than Stalin was, though Stalin certainly matched him in sheer degree of evil.
Yes.
But if Hitler had followed the advice of some of his generals and who advised him don't invade the Soviet Union, it's yes. ultimately an impossible thing to do, and had continued to respect the Nazi-Soviet pact, instead gone at England,
yeah,
he might very well have overwhelmed England.
He might have won the war, yeah, and also if he'd taken his general's advice and concentrated on just Moscow or just the south. But his great mistake was to sort of listen to advice from both sides and then split the armies. And actually, that was the decisive mistake of the war. But, you know, it was a very close-run thing. There's an amazing moment.
You know, you're, when you say that, you are quoting the victor at Waterloo.
Yes, yes.
Who
it's
says
a very close-run thing.
It was a very close-run thing, their victory.
That's right. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's a moment in December, October, November 1941, when they really are approaching Moscow, and Stalin says he's going to leave Moscow. And if he had left, I think it would have, the regime would have collapsed. And there's this amazing moment when he even, all his library, his beloved 20,000 books, are packed into his train, his planes are ready, his Douglas, American planes are ready, with their with propellers going. And there's one story that he actually went to the train and walked along through the smoke and the steam billowing out of the locomotive. And he walked along the platform, and then he just, a platform, by the way, empty except for a table with phones on it, so he could, you know, which always followed him around, so he could phone any part of the Soviet Empire. And he walked along there, a lonely little old man, skin and bone he was then, he was so under such stress. And he walked along through the steam, and then he said, "We're not leaving, we're staying in Moscow." And that, I think, is one of the decisive moments of the war. Very dramatic.
We want to go shortly to the phones for calls from our listeners. Indeed, I'll invite those calls right now. The lines are open. The number is 591-7200. 591-7200. If you are listening to us on the Internet at some greater distance and would rather reach us via email, the email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension720 as one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200. Whatever questions you've got, do by all means move quickly and give us a ring or give us your email message. Before we go to another batch of commercials, Simon, and then on to the phones, we've said nothing. Time is so short, your book is so richly detailed, and there's so much in it. But let's go, if only briefly, to the post-war years.
Yes.
And to the madness at the end and the decline.
It was a really amazing time. This is the time, actually, that we know least about. And luckily, we now have all these new documents, and we can tell it. And it really was an extraordinary time. Now you have old Stalin holding these dinners where men had to dance together, where people were so drunk so much that they vomited and had to be dragged from the table by their bodyguards and taken home, put to bed, where Khrushchev wet himself after drinking too much, where people put tomatoes on people's seats so that they sat on them, where Beria would put tomatoes in the dapper Mikoyan suit and then push them against the wall, where people fell into the pond outside Stalin's dining room so often that the bodyguards had to drain it in case a magnate drowned there, and where one time they actually drunkenly walked out and tried to shoot some partridges that they had in a coop there, and Stalin was so drunk or perhaps, you know, old and weak, that he let the gun off by mistake and shot two of his bodyguards in the eye. I mean, this was just a crazy time. Every night they'd watch the cinema, and in the cinema itself, you know, Stalin was ruling the Soviet Union from the cinema, watching Goebbels' old library of films. Bizarrely, they'd captured Goebbels' movies, and they loved cowboy films, John Wayne films. John Ford, director, was one of his favorite directors.
Those cavalry epics.
Yeah. All those epics. Beria himself loved Mexican cowboy films, you know, cowboy films. He always associated himself not with the American cowboys, but with the Mexican bandits.
Mm-hmm.
He felt he was one of them. And this, you know, the watching of these films was just surreal. Stalin would sit there, and he'd view the film. He was supreme censor. And oftentimes he'd call in the director or the actor and tell him he liked it or he hated it. Sometimes he said, "This film is so bad, it's a nightmare. You've got to remake the film." And one of the funny things that they watched these American movies, but they didn't speak any English. So they had this ludicrous minister of cinema who spoke not a word of English, and they used to make him interpret. So he spent his whole time in his office every day learning with an interpreter what was going on in these films. And then when the films were shown in Stalin's cinema, they'd say, "What's he saying now?" And he'd say, "I don't know what he's saying, but he's walking along the street," and they'd all roar with laughter. "Say, what's he saying now?" they'd say, and he'd go, "He's not. He's just scratching his head, or he's just drawing his gun. They'd roar with laughter and scream and say, "Go on, tell us more, tell us more." And of course, they never got a real interpreter because poor old Bolshakov was so entertaining, And of course, if Stalin was incredibly prim. He hated seeing any nudity. And when there was a kiss in one film, he said, "That kiss has gone on much too long." And so they immediately banned all kissing in all Soviet movies, which then had to be rescinded. And of course, he thought of himself as Ivan the Terrible. So when Ivan the Terrible, the movie was made by the great Eisenstein, Ivan the Terrible had a long beard and kissed somebody. And Stalin said, "Ivan the Terrible would never have kissed that long, and nor would his beard have been that long." So they had to remake that scene too. So surreal stuff.
The madness of his final days, or was it madness, or was there some deeper logic to it, was the doctor's plot and the new revival of anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union.
No, I don't think he was ever really mad. I mean, he deteriorated, and I think he was isolated, and he became more paranoid. Of course, again, the paranoia was understandable. America was way ahead of Russia. Russia was scrambling to catch up, and Stalin remained the master of his resources, the master organizer of terror, and he supported the foundation of Israel. But he became then a fanatical, frenzied anti-Semite.
On what grounds?
When he realized that Israel was not going to be a Soviet satellite as he'd hoped, which is why he'd recognized it first, even before America. He also was aware that many of the inner circle around him were Jewish or had Jewish wives, and he created this paradigm that the Jews were a fifth column within the Soviet Union, a traditional Russian prejudice, of course,
The term
and that.
that they used at that time was rootless
Rootless
cosmopolitans.
cosmopolitans, they belong nowhere, but they were really agents for Israel and America. And of course, the irony of this, most history books treat this as his maddest idea. But of course, this is the idea that's being peddled in most of the Arab media at this very moment, and in many of the more respectable leftist European media,
Quite right.
especially in my native England. And, it's very ironic that everyone thinks that's mad. No, I think it was, he knew what he was doing, and he also could use this, to destroy Molotov, whose wife was Jewish and who had met Golda Meir when she visited Moscow, the future Israeli
He
prime minister.
imprisoned Molotov's wife, did he
He
not?
imprisoned Molotov's wife, accused her of having group sex with young men, which was enormously unlikely, and Molotov actually had the courage to vote against this. And by the way, in this archive, we have all Molotov's love letters with his wife, which are, of course, fascinating. Molotov turns out to be a passionate love letter writer and also a man of enormous vanity who's always writing to his wife, "Did you see me in the newspaper yesterday? I'm in several times. I enclosed the cutting here. See me and my big picture on page 1, 7 and 8 or whatever."
Oh dear. We must pause. My oh dear is partly that my frustration at having to go to commercials once again, though that keeps us going. Some commercials coming, and then we will go directly on to the phones for your questions and or comments to Simon Sebag Montefiore, author of the book that we've been drawing from tonight, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. We return after this. Our guest tonight is Simon Sebag Montefiore, who is the author of a very important and an utterly readable and a downright engrossing new book, and a book of great value for our comprehension of the strange history we've been through over the last 50 or, for that matter, 100 years. Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, is just published by Alfred Knopf and Company. Of this book, which was published a bit earlier in the UK, we have fascinating comments. John Le Carré says, Montefiore's Stalin is horrific, revelatory, and sobering, a triumph of research. Andrew Roberts in the Daily Telegraph says, anyone reading this book will feel profound gratitude to Montefiore for a fascinating investigative analysis of the pathology behind the greatest and most senseless sustained bloodletting in world history. And I would certainly second those comments. I've been reading this book for the last 2 or 3 days, and I still have a bit more of it to go, and I will certainly finish it. In fact, I would, if I were teaching a course related to these matters, as I may be doing in a while, I would certainly assign portions of it at least. Simon, here is a question from one of our listeners via email.
Sure.
I've been reading your guest's book, and it's absolutely fascinating. Stalin had two physical characteristics that I think had a real influence on his character. He was a short guy, and he had a damaged arm. Could Mr. Montefiore please comment?
Yes, that's a very good point. Yeah, he did. He had webbed feet, and this arm. We're not quite sure how he damaged the arm. It may have been a carriage crash. It may have been his father may have beaten him and damaged it. But for most of the time, the arm wasn't too noticeable. But as he got older and his arthritis set in, it began to sort of shrink and stiffen, and then it becomes much more visible. But he was very shy about being naked, and the arm may have been something to do with it. In fact, and there were very few people. He didn't mind going to the banya, the Russian bath, with his sons, for example. He went with Kirov and Zhdanov, who he was at home with, but he wouldn't go with anybody. And he didn't like swimming, which is also interesting. He had special swimming pools, which I found he had specially pools made so he could bathe without really having to swim.
Well, I didn't know this, but I learned this from your book that he also suffered from psoriasis. Is that right?
That's right. He suffered from psoriasis. He suffered from sort of nervous-based illnesses. He'd get strep throat, very bad sore throat and fever at times of great stress, like at the beginning of the Great Terror. And I think one interesting thing, just to go back to the arm, is that he made one very, I'm not sure we want to know much about Stalin as lover, but one interesting thing he did say was, the only thing he's ever spoke about it, which I think gives you can make of it what you will, was when he said, I don't really like slow dancing or waltzing with women because of my arm, I can't hold them properly. Interesting.
What do we know, in fact, about his, to use the phrase rather indiscreetly, his love life? You've suggested he had a number of illegitimate children. His wife committed suicide in 1932, and he did not marry again.
No, I mean, of course, this story is, this book is really about not only about how they ruled and how Stalin ruled, but also how they lived. And of course, that
Yes.
very much includes the women's and children's stories. And I have a lot of new material on that. So it's an interesting, really interesting question. He was quite a flirt. There's a lot of evidence that he had an affair after his wife's death. I mean, there's quite a lot of suggestion, and his wife certainly believed it, that he had affairs throughout his marriage, in fact, which, of course, as you know, Milton, is what a Georgian man regards as his prerogative anyway. After all, the Georgians are sort of the Italians of the Russian
And
Empire.
perhaps men of great power regard that generally
Yes,
as their prerogative.
yes. I mean, we know about some of his affairs. He had a big flirtation, certainly with the hairdresser in the Kremlin. But after his wife's death, he began this affair with his sister-in-law, to be exact, the wife of Nadia, his wife's brother. And this woman was a very outspoken, intelligent, rather fun woman with big dimples and big Cheshire cat smile. And imagine my amazement in these archives when I was looking through and I found a group photo of Stalin with these women and with amazingly uninhibited, especially for Stalin, a pose, this mistress sitting right between his legs on the floor while he sat on a chair, which in this picture is in the book. And I think that's fascinating. But after that, he settled down. He began to realize that he believed that women were untrustworthy and that they were a sort of security hazard. And the less people knew about it, the better. So after all, he knew that he was being spied on by his own secret police, potentially. So then he settled down for the rest of his life with his housekeeper, a buxom, always smiling Russian peasant woman called Valechka. And that is a fascinating thing because, of course, Valechka also served when Churchill and people came for dinners at the Kremlin. Valechka served, and yet no one ever noticed that this smiley, buxom woman who discreetly came in and out bringing the food, wearing a white apron, was in fact Stalin's secret mistress.
And she was to the end, was she?
She was to the end, and in the death scene, it was she that mourned him. She thought he was the best man that had ever lived. And when he died, she threw herself onto his chest after all the leaders had gone and howled, and mourning him in the way that the common people in Russia mourned their loved.
Do they still, you've been spent a lot of time in the former Soviet Union in recent years,
Yes.
and down in the south in Georgia and the neighboring Republic, what is it called?
Armenia, Azerbaijan, to one side, and then
It's
Abkhazia, and
Abkhazia I'm thinking
that's
of.
right.
Yeah. Is he held in greater reverence down there than he is up in Russia proper?
Well, he's actually held in a lot of reverence in Russia properly. I mean, the latest survey says that 26% of Russians today would vote for Stalin. But there's an interesting story about that. You know, it was a great adventure going to visit all these houses and photographing them for the book, where Stalin spent so much time on the Black Sea. And when I went there, you know, you had to go by a United Nations peacekeeping helicopter into the Abkhazia, which is this kind of bandit republic. And I went to all the houses, and of course, you know, these houses, it turned out, these are the houses that it turned out had been visited in the 70s by Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, which is very revealing. And it turns out that Saddam was absolutely obsessed with Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
And
you suggest that the Ba'athist Party is actually an imitation of the Soviet Communist Party.
I think it's pretty close. It's a sort of, I suppose it's sort of socialist, sort of nationalist socialist, but then Bolshevism became a sort of nationalist red nationalism, didn't it? I think there's a real parallel between the two. Certainly, Saddam's use of these, you know, when he arrested all his enemies in one big meeting, that was definitely based on Stalin. He talked about Stalin all the time, and indeed, he told his top people like Tariq Aziz and others. He said to them, you know, what I really admire about Stalin is that he, you know, he died in his bed, and he was still in power.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Saddam is going to do either of those two things, do you?
Let us return to the phones. No, I don't think he will. 591-7200 is the number. One or two lines are now available. If you've been trying to reach us, do certainly try again. And here is a phone call. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. I'm enjoying your program, as always.
Thank you, sir.
It's interesting you mentioned Saddam Hussein, because that's kind of where my question was leading. I'm always amazed at people like Saddam and Stalin, as your guest is talking about, being able to maintain and hold power for so long and be so devious and so evil. Why is it that, and probably your perspective as well as a sociologist, why is it that no one steps up and assassinates these people? And were there many purges or putsches or attempts on his life? And could you discuss that briefly?
By all means, Simon.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, you know, Stalin certainly believed there would be, and he knew he had a lot of enemies. But the irony of it is that he killed so many people, including his potential enemies, that there really was no one left. And of course, the people round him, who he played off against each other, charmed, promoted, demoted, humiliated, built up again. They believed in Stalin as the greatest man in the communist movement, his role in history. And of course, you know, they believed in the idea. They believed in the idea, and that was the decisive thing, I think. But there was no real assassination attempt of Stalin. But Stalin was always aware that his own guards could assassinate him. And indeed, there's a famous occasion where he's walking along the corridor in the Kremlin, and in these corridors they had literally a guard every 10 yards. And these guards would look straight ahead and then look to the left and sort of pass on the guardianship to the next guard, and then look straight ahead again, if you see what I mean. And as he walked along, Stalin said to someone he was with, he said, you know, you never know if the bullet's going to hit you from behind or in front, you know, which is what he said. So I think it's a good point you ask.
Thank you very much.
We thank you, sir. And Simon, we must catch up with the commercials. We're going to do
of
that
course.
Right now, and then back to additional telephone calls. 591-7200, the number. Lines are available. If you've been trying to reach us, we've cleared a number of lines, so do certainly try again quickly, and somebody will get through. 591-7200 if you want to email us. That's at extension720@tribune.com. And directly back to Simon Sebag Montefiore, author of Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, and on to your calls for him, 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello, Milt.
Yes, sir.
Yes, my question was something, goes back to something your guest said a little earlier. He mentioned that Beria was not a true believer. And I was just wondering, does he believe that Stalin was really committed to the communist ideology? Or was it more the way I would tend to believe, that the communism was just a system he was able to twist to his own means and his own devices to become a dictator and to amass as much power as possible? Like, I just don't believe he was committed the ideals of communism. It was just it was like Hitler. He could have, if he was in Germany, he could easily have been a Nazi. Whatever would have allowed him to amass the power that he did in his life was all he was really looking for.
Yes, let's get a reaction to that thought, Simon.
That's a good question, sir. I think he really did believe. I disagree with you about that. I mean, I believe strongly from my research that he was actually as I said earlier, I think a quasi-Islamic fanatic in his belief in Marxism, and it was a belief that he was a religious, he was religious until a certain age, and then he suddenly became this this fanatic, fanatical Marxist. And I think that, but I think you've got to realize it's not just Bolshevism was not just a belief in the ideals of Marxism. It was also a sort of club, a culture, and it was one that suited him terribly well as a man. You know, it was based on intrigue, it was secret, it was based on toughness, it was based on constant struggle. These are all things that were made for Stalin. And so the whole sort of, it wasn't just the idea, which I think he embraced. And another thing I think is interesting is that, you know, this fanatical dogma suited Stalin very well. It also suited lots of them. They all came from religious households. Yeah. They all trained as priests, or as often they were from very religious Jewish households. But they were brought up with ultra-religion, and that suited Bolshevism as well.
Our thanks to the caller. Let's go quickly to another. And you are on the air. Good evening.
I'm interested.
Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I'm specifically interested in Lazar Kaganovich, who was Jewish and who,
sure,
I understood was Stalin's chief of staff for a long, long period of time. In your book, I think you say that he lasted through the 30s. I'm trying to understand how he managed to survive, because he died, I think, at age 92.
That's right.
Rather recently. I'm sort of interested in him because he's a cousin of mine.
Oh, you're really? Another Kaganovich or Kagan, are you?
Yeah. Well, no. My father's father and Kaganovich's mother were brother and sister.
Is that so?
Yeah. At any rate, because he was Jewish, and I'm kind of wondering how he managed to survive. And he, as I understand it, he retired, lived on a pension, and at one point aspired. There was a book recently, The Wolf of the Kremlin, a biography.
We mentioned it earlier, sir.
Yeah, I did. He didn't hear that part. At any rate, how did he manage to survive and get through all of this and manage to retire nicely, as I understand it? And,
yes. Yes, sir. It's very nice to have you on the air. Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, Kaganovich was one of the toughest, and he was highly intelligent in his way, uneducated. Came, as I mentioned, from a very orthodox Jewish family.
Right.
He was Stalin's sort of deputy in the 30s, and he was very close to Stalin. Stalin used to say, you know, call me Koba, call me Joseph Vissarionovich, use the intimate you in Russian. And he said, oh, I never would. He said, I respect you too much. But Stalin would also, in these letters which I found, which are fascinating, Stalin would lecture him and say, you learned how to write properly, Kaganovich. Learn how to use punctuation, which is hilarious if you think that Kaganovich was then the second man in the Russian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
But the Jewish aspect is interesting. Now, you see, Stalin hated Jews like Trotsky, who were haughty intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't have a problem at that time anyway with Jews who were working class, and Kaganovich was a cobbler. Once, they used to tell anti-Jewish jokes, anti-Armenian jokes, anti-Georgian jokes, this group of men. And But Stalin one day noticed that Kaganovich flinched when he told a Jewish joke. So he said, Lazar, what's the problem? You know, why do you flinch? And Kaganovich said, you know, we're very sensitive. We've been persecuted all our history. We Jews are like the mimosa flower. You know, we're touched, we close up. So Stalin then banned any anti-Semitic jokes to be told in front of Kaganovich and never told them again for the rest of his life. And he also said, Jews don't drink. So Kaganovich doesn't have to drink. Everyone else had to drink. So he was always treated Kaganovich very carefully. But Kaganovich actually was, without disrespect to your family, the biggest, a sort of swaggering, swaggering bully.
Anti-Semite, wasn't he?
A swaggering bully. He wasn't anti-Semite. You know, you could say it like that. He was, you know, they believed they were internationalists and they weren't Jews at all. He was a swaggering bully, a coward, and incredibly servile to Stalin. And you ask how he survived. He survived by appalling servility and the most bloodthirsty brutality of virtually anybody except Molotov and the other of these top people. Mm. He was a disgusting man, actually.
Yes, that's what I understand.
But his grandson told me that the moment he tried to overthrow Khrushchev after Stalin's death,
mm-hmm.
and when he failed, he retired. And his grandson told me that the moment he retired, he stopped losing his temper and shouting all the time, and he just became a very sweet old man. And you're right. You know the rest of the story.
Of course, he was not the only survivor, thanks to that caller, of the original circle. Molotov lasted until just a few years ago, did he not?
Yeah. In fact, you know, what's little understood, and one of the themes of this book, is that Stalin was actually a kind of loyal patron to the kind of people who were really loyal to him.
To the ones he didn't kill.
To the ones he didn't kill.
Yes.
But he didn't really kill people he was really in his own... No. They were constant. You know, Kaganovich, Voroshilov, Molotov, Mikoyan, Khrushchev, Beria... They all survived all the way through.
What about this? What about his once very, very close friend, Orjonikidze?
Ah, yeah. See, Orjonikidze, I found a lot of letters between them. Orjonikidze was a marvellous sort of swaggering Georgian who rode a white right horse through the centre of Tbilisi when the Red Army took it, and was almost like Stalin's brother. And in fact, he was so close to Stalin in the 30s that he'd often tell Stalin what to do or disagree with Stalin, argue with Stalin.
But that reminds me to ask you, I was wondering, I read this, why do you refer to almost all of them by their family names, but you often refer to Orjonikidze as Sergo.
Yeah, each of these, you know, this Bolshevik culture was so peculiar. They all had special party monikers, party nicknames. And his nickname was Sergo, and everyone called him Sergo. He was known as Comrade Sergo. Similarly, Molotov's wife, I always call her Polina, but she was known by everyone as Comrade Zhemchuzhina, which means Miss Pearl, which was, you know, her name Polina was short for Pearl, the name. So they all had these strange names, and of course Stalin was a man of many names. Zhugashvili was his original one.
Yeah.
Then he became the Man of Steel. Molotov's real name was Scriabin. Then he became the Hammer Man, and so on.
The bad end to which Orjonikidze came. What tell that story, if only briefly.
He began to cross Stalin as the terror began. Orjonikidze, who was so close to Stalin but so strong, and was a very sort of he was regarded as the perfect Bolshevik. He began to resist Stalin, and finally that they reached a sort of point of collision, and he committed suicide, and his wife rang up Stalin and said when she got on the phone, she said, Orjonikidze has done it. My husband's done exactly what Nadia did.
Yeah, the wife.
Yeah, and Stalin put the phone down. He hated people committing suicide. It was a personal rejection and humiliation. But of course, it was very useful for him, for Orjonikidze to be out of the way, because he was the last big beast of the Bolshevik jungle who could stand up to Stalin. Mm. So it was a decisive moment, that.
We have a last batch of commercials to take care of, Simon. We shall return directly after this. And quickly back to the phones. You are on the air. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Hi, hello?
Yes, sir, go ahead, please.
Hi. How intellectuals outside of Russia responded when evidence of the purges came out, particularly just the left-wing, just members of the Communist Party in the U.S. or in Europe. Did evidence of the purges ever really change anyone's mind?
Sir, your signal is rather poor, so we will thank you for the call, but... disconnect. And all the same, did you get that question, Simon?
Yeah, very good question. Thank you, sir, for your call. I think people knew that this murder was going on. Churchill knew. I mean, lots of people worked it out and changed their views. Why did people like George Bernard Shaw, for example, or others continue to support support the Soviet Union or be taken in by Stalin's propaganda? It's one of the great mysteries. I think it's because they felt the idea was philanthropic, and they chose to ignore it. But it is extraordinary. I mean, of course, the stupidest person of all was the U.S. ambassador, FDR's ambassador to Moscow, Joseph Davis, whose book was later made into a movie, Mission to Moscow. And he was a lawyer, and he made the amazing comments to FDR, in which he claimed that the show trials, which were absolutely absurd, were legalistically completely watertight, he said, and he was completely taken in by it, which is just incredible, isn't it, Milt?
Well, you remember, in this country, there are some who still stood by it, some of the communist intellectuals who stood by it,
yeah,
and other leftists disposed to think favorably of the Soviet Union against all prevailing evidence. But there were lots of people who had these scales falling from the eyes experience.
Yes.
And there was an interesting response. A commission was established. I forget just how it was originally organized, but John Dewey, the American philosopher, headed the commission to look into the purge trials and reach a considered independent judgment as to whether they were show trials or whether there was real complicity and guilt on the part of the defendants. And they did come to the conclusion that these trials could not be trusted.
Yes, well, that's, you know, that's good. That's good. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable that anyone fell for them. They were so extraordinary, these trials.
Well, the will to believe on the part of the good communist in those days was a very strong force, don't you think?
But, you know, but guilt...
It was strong in the Soviet Union, it was strong in the Western world as well.
Absolutely, but of course... and, of course, it was linked to anti-fascism. But guilt was a fascinating thing. I mean, they asked Molotov, were these people guilty? And he said, as an old man, he looked back and he said, well, they weren't exactly guilty, but they might have been guilty. And Stalin himself said, and I found this in a fascinating letter, he said, we've got to kill these people because, you know, they lack faith. He said they lack faith in the project. And that was an interesting comment, which reveals a lot.
When you really come down to it, what a truly horrifying man he was.
I've got to say, I mean, you know, I said at the beginning, and I just want to say it again. You know, this book humanizes these people, shows them as men, as women, as wives, as children, as fathers. But essentially, this is a chronicle of horror, of perversion, of murder, of sadism, of degeneracy, depravity, and along with luxury and power. But these are the most diabolical people that have ever run a country, except for the Nazis. And you know, I've been keeping company with them for these few years writing this book, and I've had nightmares, believe me.
I can well believe you. You've also visited with many of their descendants.
Yes.
How do they reconcile, or how do they integrate with their present commitments, their memory of the father or the grandfather or what have you?
They, I mean, some of them have become great liberals, and the Khrushchevs have, for example. But some of them, and the Mikoyans have. And the Mikoyans are, you know, a great
family. I met Mikoyan's son,
Sergo,
some years ago.
Yeah.
I believe he's living in Boston, is he not?
He comes to Boston quite a lot.
Yeah.
He's a charming person. In fact, I like the Mikoyans very much. But other ones, like Andreev's daughter, I don't know if I mentioned her earlier. But you know, she remains an absolute diehard Stalinist, and she's the one who when I said, did your father kill lots of people? She said, absolutely not. Her father was an absolute butcher.
Yeah.
But and in fact, just after she told me he didn't kill anybody, I went to the archives and found his file by coincidence, and it was just a sort of roadshow of mass murder. But she said to me, you know, you Americans and Jews have killed many more people in Russia than my father ever did, or Stalin ever did. And I said, how so? She said, well, you brought AIDS into Russia, she said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're sort of, and she's the one who said, you know, my mother, Dora Khazan, who was a big character in the book, one of Stalin's top people, she said she could recognize an enemy of the people by looking into their eyes.
And so could I, she says.
Yes, yeah. And so could I. And she said, Simon, are you an enemy of the people?
Yeah.
Chilling.
Stalin had three legitimate children, so to speak.
Yes.
We knew Svetlana in this country, of course. She came here.
Yeah, you know her well.
Wrote a few books. She went back to the Soviet Union and then came back here yet once again, I believe.
She went to England for a while, and then she went back again, and now she's here again. And she's living somewhere in the Midwest, I believe.
Is she? I didn't know that she was in the neighborhood, as it were.
She might be listening.
Does she have a husband?
No, I think she's on her own now.
She married an American architect, and
Peters.
That led to a divorce after a while, I guess.
She's a very intelligent woman, but I think she's been through a painful experience.
Oh, good Lord, yes. Of the other two sons, what do we know?
The elder son, Jacob in English, was captured by the Nazis. Stalin initially believed he was a traitor, arrested his wife, who was left behind, and damned him, and then gradually discovered to his surprise that Yasha had never betrayed him and had died an honorable death in the camp, committing suicide on the wire. And then I've discovered that Stalin, this is new, Stalin began to reminisce a lot about Yasha and regretted misunderstanding him and that he died a hero, which is interesting. And then Vasily became what Svetlana called the crown prince of the regime, overpromoted to general, a terrifying popinjay, a sort of bullying jackanapes, drunk, shooting out chandeliers with his pistol, seducing women. Stalin didn't know what to do with him, and in the end he became an alcoholic, and Stalin insisted on booking him into what the Soviet version of the Betty Ford Clinic, which didn't work. And after Stalin's deathbed, Vasily wandered in drunkenly and shouted at Molotov and everyone, "You've murdered him, you've murdered him." And after Stalin's death, he was imprisoned and died of alcoholism, tragically, far from Moscow.
We have only about a minute left. You have another project in view, do you?
I'm still recovering from Stalin.
It will take some time, I should say.
Like to go back to the 18th century. But, you know, I'm still haunted by this book. And, you know, Stalin was obsessed with how people behaved at their executions. He always wanted to know. And that's always been my dream, my nightmare, is like how I would behave at my execution, having written about all these. So I need to sort of exercise this ghost. And I hope that in many ways this book will help exercise, you know, bring Stalin to a new audience and show how this kind of thing can happen. It's a warning from history, as well as an entertainment, as well as a fascinating story. But I also hope that in Russia, it helps redeem them, in a sense, reveal to them what really happened.
Has it yet been published in Russia?
Yes, it's been bought by a Russian publisher. But it'll be interesting to see what they make of it. I don't think they'll be terribly happy with it.
It will indeed. I must ask you, though, we've only literally got half a minute left. You did a piece, I forget in which newspaper, comparing Stalin to Putin.
Yes.
There's obviously a difference. What's the similarity?
The real connection, if I could say, is that Putin's grandfather was Stalin's cook.
I didn't know that.
And he was the most world historical cook in all of history, because he served both. Putin's grandfather served Rasputin, Lenin, and then cooked for Stalin, which is a pretty amazing culinary effort, isn't it?
It is indeed. I fear we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've loved being in. I love America, so it's lovely to be here.
Thank you once again. And with that, we will close down for the evening with a quick word about programs to come. Tomorrow night there's a ball game. We'll have a tape after that. And then on Monday, my guest will be an old friend, the distinguished American political journalist Tom Wicker, who's got a new book about the first President Bush. We'll talk about that and about contemporary American politics with Tom Wicker Monday. And we'll be with you tomorrow after the ball game. Until then, a cordial good night.